Good evening, everybody. It is an honor to be here at my last, and perhaps the last, White House Correspondents' Day. You all look great. The end of the Republic has never looked better. I do apologize. I know I was a little late tonight. I was running on CPT. Which stands for jokes that white people should not make. Tip for you, Jeff. Anyway, here we are. My eighth and final appearance at this unique event. And I am excited. If this material works well, I'm going to use it at Goldman Sachs next year.
Live from the Genesis Art Supply Building on North Elston Avenue, just this side of the concrete-encrusted banks of the North Branch of the Chicago River, it's The Mike Novak Show, still Chicago's only locally broadcast deep green gardening and environment program, heard every Sunday on Q4 Radio and at MikeNovak.net.
Good planets are hard to find, temperate zones and tropic climes. True currents and thriving seas, wind blowing through breathing trees, strong ozone and safe sunshine. Well, good planets are hard to find.
Nothing stopping him from running for president, except for the fear of getting shin splints. Here he is, Mike Novak.
I bet that's all on the air here, too. That's okay. Good morning. Hey, everybody. How you doing? We're having Twitter issues. No, not Twitter issues.
Skype.
Skype issues. Okay.
It's all those clouds out there. That's what's
my goodness.
Up here.
Okay. That's the way it rolls here. It's been a little more than I bargained for this morning to start. Yeah, and there's the ding. And I'm just trying to hear myself in my headsets, and that's not working very well either. And so it's going to be a long morning. Welcome. It's the Mike Novak Show. Can we get a little more volume on this? All right. I don't know how we do this. There we go.
There we go.
You just turn all the dials on the dang thing until it comes up. Okay. But see, okay. How did I dial? All right. Here's what we're going to do. Stand by. I am in the process of, where did we hit the contacts? Okay. Let's add a contact. I thought I typed the right one. So Katie Copsey is she calling?
She's sending you a request.
Oh, okay.
There she
is. Oh, let's bring her in right now. Okay. All right. We're going to do that.
See, it all worked.
Whoa, why am I getting music? That didn't all work out.
Uh-oh.
Supposed to be getting Katie Copsey. I can see her there. Hold on. That's not good. That's not good at all. That is not good at all. Okay. Katie, hang on. I don't know if you can hear me. Why don't you call her? hey, everybody, welcome to the show. It's a Sunday morning and it's raining in Chicago.
Yeah, well, that's it. Can we just have her call the studio line?
But it comes up there. That's where it comes up. It comes up through the thing that's playing.
Men in black winning, black Tim's black.
That's what's playing. On the menu on the bottom screen, make sure that nothing is playing on iTunes. Oh, maybe that's it. We're going to go to the iTunes.
Try it now.
Ah, Mr. Turk. You're brilliant. Kate, are you there by any chance?
I'm here, yes.
Okay. Wow. Thanks, Bill Turk, who texted in immediately to let me know what the glitch was. And I thought I had turned that off, but I had not turned that off. Okay, we're cool, Peggy. Come on back in here. Yeah, independent radio, folks. That's what it is. It's a cross. It's a mixture. It's a cross between pirate radio and college radio somehow. And here we are. It's the Mike Novak Show. Good morning. I apologize for the first 7 minutes, okay? Do we just delete that from the file, from the audio file?
We'll take it off the podcast.
Believe me, it's gone. Consider it gone off the podcast. And Peggy Malecki is here with me this morning. Kate, hang on just a second while I do an intro of the show to let people know what we're going to do here. Now, I need my coffee. Is that here someplace, too?
Did it make it into the studio?
It's right here.
Oh, it's right in front of you, Mike. Right in front of me. okay.
Happy May 1st, everyone.
Oh, really? May Day.
Yes.
Let's go protest something. All right? Let's throw a brick through a window someplace. All right, hold on. Oh, this is no way to treat a guy who's just a week out of his hospital bed. This is not the right way to behave and to make nice with him. And by the way, let me thank all the people who have sent me messages and cards and good wishes. I'm feeling much better. As you can see, I'm better enough to get angry and frustrated. Here's the thing, though. So I get out of the hospital. And, you know, I mentioned it last week. I'm not going to go into details. But the overnight stay turned into 9 days. Okay. Now I have just graduated in the last couple of days to being able to eat cream of wheat. Cream of wheat. And macaroni and cheese. Ooh. Last night I had fish. I had tilapia. And
pureed?
No. I was actually able to. It's soft. It's pretty soft. Okay. Tilapia. I was able to eat that. And lots of liquids, so I go to the bathroom about every 5 minutes, I'm feeling better. So my caretaker, a.k.a. Kathleen, a.k.a. the love of my life, is taking care of me a few days out of the hospital. Last Tuesday, she slips and falls, breaks her wrist. Okay? My caretaker. Love you, Kathleen. So we go to Northwestern, and they put a splint on it and say, okay, you need surgery, but we're not going to do it until Tuesday. So the arm is still broken. The wrist is still broken. It's all puffy because what they said is we're going to wait till the swelling goes down. Well, the swelling's not going down. In fact, it's getting worse. Mm-hmm. Until last night, she finally said, screw that. I'm icing this puppy because they never said anything about, well, really? You might want to ice it to bring down the swelling. Don't you think that maybe a doctor would say, you know, you could ice that if you want to bring down the swelling? So she's icing it now, and we go in Tuesday, and she's going to have surgery. And they say that she begins therapy the next day. Wow. So that's the story there. So if anything bad happens in my household, anything else bad happens in my household – there's obviously a conspiracy afoot. Somebody's out to get us. That's the way that works. Okay. So again, thank you to everybody. And believe me, people have been on this and watching and listening and just sending wonderful messages, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. It's just been fabulous. Today's show, speaking of things that are interesting, I posted yesterday about the second part of today's show, which is about Starved Rock State Park. And I've been covering this issue for more than 4 years. I found out about this from people like Ashley Williams, who is a member of the team, and who lives out LaSalle County way, where there's a, well, at least until recently, there was what they call a frack sand rush, meaning that frack sand mines were opening all over the place, creating a moonscape in the county of LaSalle. It was because of the fracking boom and the need for oil and gas. I don't know if we need it, but there was a demand for it. And the silica sand in LaSalle County is some of the purest in the world and perfect for fracking. So they were digging mines like crazy, and it kind of, you know, I don't think it started with Mississippi sand, but they decided they were going to take a plot of former farmland adjacent to Starved Rock State Park, the eastern entrance, and dig a huge 80-foot deep pit and mine sand out of it. Well, several environmental organizations took them to, well, the IDNR approved it, by the way. First of all, the county board approved it. Then the IDNR approved it. And we'll go into this in the second hour. And then several environmental organizations said, not so fast, we're suing you because we don't think you did it right. And took them to court. And at least it was slowing the process down. And then I find out a month ago, actually at the Good Food Festival, that the court case was over. And the Enviros lost. And I had no idea because there has been no media coverage Nothing. Of this at all. Zip, nada.
Nothing. Not. I haven't even seen it in a lot of the emails that come through that are the collaborations, you know, that where they go to all the different reports. Nothing. Yeah. It's gone off the radar.
So, and I found this out from Albert Ettinger, who is a lawyer and who was on the case, and he has done a lot of environmental work over the years, including for the ELPC, Environmental Law and Policy Center, is now in charge of his own practice. And he was the one. He said, we lost. I said, are you kidding me? So I said, you got to be on my show. And we have to talk about this. And so he is. He's going to be here along with Cindy Scruckroot, who's the water program director for the Illinois chapter of the Sierra Club, clean water program director. And the Illinois Sierra Club was one of the people who sued, as was Open Lands, as was Prairie Rivers Network. So they will be on, oh, and how can I forget, Merlin and Susan Dodd Calhoun, who have been on the program before. They live right next to this open pit mine, which has not yet been dug, and that's kind of an interesting story too. Because things have changed. Remember I said there was a frack sand rush. Of course, then the market tanked for oil. And we're still in the tank phase, which means that there's not a lot of that going on. It's probably temporary, but I will talk to them as well, assuming that we can get them on this line and talk to them about that and what it's like to live next to a potential frack sand mine. All right. Rick DeMaio weather at 10:45 as always. And the question of the day is, what up? What's with the weather, dude?
When's the fog going away? The rain.
This is nasty, isn't it? I don't complain about weather pretty much ever. I like cold. Heat's okay. I'm not crazy about heat, actually. I like cold better than heat. But yesterday was just nasty. It was just nasty here in Chicago. And elsewhere probably not so much, but drizzly, cold, yeesh, yuck.
2 days of wind chills in the 30s?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just,
no thanks.
Yeah. Blah.
Mr. DeMaio, you better have a good explanation.
You better, dude. Okay. Let's go to the phone. Kate Copsey, you're a very patient woman.
That's okay. Yes.
Good morning,
yes,
Kate.
Yes, and I do agree with you about the fracking. I mean, I think that's an environmental disaster waiting to happen, but they're kind of like cowboys going over it.
Yeah, well, you know, and you say it's waiting to happen. It's already happening in some places. I mean, I went to Washington, D.C. For the anti-XL, Keystone XL pipeline march in 2013. And people from Pennsylvania, people from New York, not New York, Pennsylvania, and I forget where else, were bringing me jugs of water, of yellow-colored water, and saying, this came out of our tap. And so it's already an environmental disaster in certain areas. Where are you these days, Kate?
I'm in the middle of New Jersey, and it's miserable here as well.
Yeah, but it's always miserable in the middle of New Jersey, isn't it? Oh, I'm kidding. That's a joke.
And actually, I've just come back from a trip down to Charlottesville, Virginia. And it was miserable down there, too.
It's miserable everywhere. So it's cold and rainy, or is it? Was it just rainy? What was it like down there?
50 degrees and drizzle. Not quite rain, but kind of fog that kind of creeps under the coat and into your fingers and yuck.
Okay, I will accept yuck. And that's what it's been like here. But as you know, because you're a gardener, you look at yuck. And some people's yuck is other people's, this is great for spring vegetables. Am I right?
Well, probably, but it's really, I don't know, it's kind of just that damp. I mean, it's not really seeping in. We're about 5 inches low for the year, for the spring with rainfall. And, you know, you don't mind if it's a good rain, but it's not really raining. It's just kind of hanging there. So, you know, I mean, I don't think, you know, the lilac is just kind of the leaves are drooping down. And, you know, everybody's just saying we had such a nice spring and such a nice run up to this. And then,
Yeah.
I'm sure it's going to get better, but you know, right now, I mean, instead of playing in the garden on a nice Sunday, I'm down to, well, maybe I should tidy the study.
But as you mentioned, with weather getting warm early and then changing, that fakes out people in their vegetable gardens and in their ornamental gardens. But veggies, in particular, I think people get all excited and they want things to happen fast, and they fail to take into account that there are different kinds of vegetables. There are cool season vegetables and there are warm season vegetables. There's a few that overlap. Not many, though. They're kind of one or the other, aren't they?
Oh, yes. I mean, the early season ones, like the lettuces and the kales and the chards and things like that, those deal with early, they're kind of out already. But, you know, I mean, I think it was the beginning of April, my husband came back from the store. I don't know whether it was one of the box stores, Walmart, something like that. And he said, they're selling tomato plants. And I'm thinking, you know, okay, it's 70 degrees and sunny now, but this is the beginning of April. We can get a frost all the way through to the middle of May, you know, and you can push an envelope 10 days before that, maybe, if the weather's good.
Right.
But, you know, why would you do that?
Well, because you're ignorant. You would do that because you really don't understand how the plants work. Let me tell you something. And by the way, let's interject here for those who are listening, that is Kate Copsey. She's the author of a brand new book, The Downsized Veggie Garden, How to Garden Small Wherever You Live, Whatever Your Space. And I, first of all, highly recommend this book, especially if you're new to this. Kate lays it out brilliantly, easy to read, easy to follow, lots of pictures. We love our pictures. It will guide you through this, especially if you, like I say, you're a novice You've not done this before, or if you just moved and you had this big backyard and you used to garden well, and you go, well, what am I going to do now? All I've got is a porch. All I've got is a balcony. Well, she takes you through that too. And that's sort of the deal of this book. But I want to ask you a question, because I'm not sure I did this right, but I was being overcautious. Kathleen and I started a bunch of tomatoes from seed. We've actually got a greenhouse out in the neighbor's backyard.
It's
one of those portable deals. It's like 8 feet tall, 7 feet tall, something like that, and maybe 4 feet to 6 feet across, something like that, and 7 or 8 feet deep, made out of that mesh plastic stuff. And we put out our tomatoes. We repotted last week, the day before Kathleen broke her wrist. Good timing. We put them in the greenhouse, and then suddenly it just got nasty cold and nasty. And the next day it was raining and like 40. And I said, you know, I think they're going to be fine in the greenhouse, but I'm also afraid they're just going to start to sulk. So why don't we grab those and bring them inside, just so they have some warmth? They're not going to get any light here, but there's no sun. We haven't had sun here for days. And I said, you know, the way the greenhouse works is that there's sun and it hits the greenhouse. It doesn't matter how cold it is outside. If you've got sun, it's going to warm up that greenhouse inside. But there was no sun. And I thought, why take a chance? So we brought all those tomatoes back indoors, and they're sitting there. And I think tomorrow we're supposed to have some sunny weather. And as soon as the sun hits, we're going to take it back out to the greenhouse, and I think we're going to be able to leave them there. But do you think I was overcautious, Kate?
Not at all. I think, you know, and that actually is the beauty of containers, because you can fudge early. Yeah, I mean, I started my tomatoes back in January because I was doing the Philadelphia home show, or the flower show, sorry. And they wanted to see some things. So I started mine out early, and they're in containers. And because I was away for 48 hours, I put them all. It's kind of like a little sunroom. It's about 3 foot wide and about 6 foot long. So you can't get much in there, you know, two chairs in there, and that's about it. But it's nice sort of during the winter. And that's where I started them. And then in that nice weather, they went outside and my tomatoes had flowers. And now I've got little baby tomatoes forming.
Wow.
But yeah, I mean, I brought them in. They've gone out this morning. I mean, we're about 55 degrees, which really for tomatoes is kind of the cutoff point, I think, during the day. The peppers really like it to be 60, 70 degrees. But I think there's something about natural rainfall and that little bit of a breeze that hardens the stems off just a little bit, that make them that little bit stronger. So I stick them all outside and bring them all back inside again, just like you're doing.
Right. And I can't do that here because I'm looking at my phone, and it's telling me the temperature is 46. So if I take mine out and try to give them that little bit of rain, a little bit of wind, they're not going to be happy in 46 degree temperatures, are they?
Yeah, and I'm still seeing a wind chill of 36. They're definitely not going to like that.
No, I'd keep them in. I mean, I've just looked at my phone. We're at 52, and it feels like 52. So we've got zip wind, and it's just hanging there. Kind of one step away from fog.
Yeah, there you are. So you're on the edge too, and that's a really good point for folks who are all itching to get their tomatoes in the ground. Now look, by the end of the week, it could hit 70 and then never leave it until October. You have to pay attention to the weather forecast. Rick DeMaio, who's going to be on later today, told me last week. He said, we're not going to see any more frosts. Don't worry about that. I mean, that was his guarantee. However, it can still be 40, and the tomatoes are not going to like that. So they're one of those warm season vegetables that you have to be a little more careful about. Like, and as you said, peppers are even worse. They're even more finicky than tomatoes. And then there's the squashes, and you don't even need to think about planting those until June. I got a buddy of mine, Dan Costa, from Vern Goer's greenhouse in Hinsdale, who says he doesn't even put squash in the ground till after the 4th of July. and that's because it avoids the squash vine borer. That's his little tip, his secret for planting squash. And I have no problem with that. I've had squash vine borer in the past couple of years, and it just decimates your plants. So
there are some though that you can get in containers, like Astia, which you can put into a container and start that in your greenhouse early. And then you'll have you won't get the little borers either if you're in a container, and then put them outside in the sunshine. And that gives you, if you want to elongate your summer squash season, I mean, that first squash is great, but you know, by the time August, maybe you don't want to have quite that much squash around. I don't know.
Yeah. By the way, I got a tweet from Patrick Berry of the Chicago Farm Report, which you can hear on this show from time to time. He says, yes, Mike, all that rain and cool air is just what our cool weather crops want, and they're doing great. So I know he has a lot of those in his yard. I've been slow to get things out, and the hospital stay didn't help. I'm way behind. By the time I get my cool season crops out, it's going to be warm. So that happens too. I got to tell you, that's one of the things about growing veggies is you got to hit those time frames. You got to get them in when they're supposed to be in. For instance, I'll give you a for instance, Kate. I have never successfully grown a pea crop because I'm always getting them out too late. And by the time they get going, it gets warm, and then they're unhappy. And you really have to get out there early to plant peas, don't you?
Oh, yes. And in fact, I had some peas that I started in that little sun area. And because that got up to about 80 degrees, I mean, they're just kind of frizzled out. Mm. I mean, I thought to start, maybe the caps were getting in there. But no, I think it's just that 80, 85 degrees in there. And I'd just forgotten to take them outside into the 50 degree daylight. And they're reviving a bit. But one of the vegetables actually that I love to plant just that little bit early from the last frost, if you've got a decent forecast, are the scarlet runner beans, because they like kind of 70 degrees. They love 70 degrees, maybe low 80s. When we get to the mid to high 80s, they peter out, but yeah, they're so colourful. And then the typical French beans and the bush beans and that type of thing, those do great up to the upper 80s, whereas these scarlet ones tend to take a rest and then come back in the fall. But there was, I think, 2 years ago, we hovered all the way through the summer with low 70s, maybe upper 70s, low 80s. And July 4th, I was still harvesting peas as well as these scarlet runner beans on July 4th weekend, because it was a very gradual heating from winter kind of through a long, cool spring. And eventually we got to summer. But so that was a great year for the peas and those cool, slightly cooler weather scarlet runner bean.
What year was that you were talking about?
I think it was 2 years ago.
Yeah, I think you're right, because I remember, because I had my book out. And we went to Uncommon Ground restaurant where they had the first organic rooftop farm in America, right here in Chicago. They're on Devon. And it was just Helen Cameron was so gracious. She let me have a book signing there. And then she gave us a tour of the rooftop garden. And I remember it was late in the season and the peas were still growing because it had been cool all season long. So, you know, you can get away with it if the weather's going to stay cool. But if it doesn't, they will, as you say, Kate, they will wither. They will not be happy. As you also point out in your book, you can plant things under them. And here's what we're going to do, Kate. Because we got a late start, we haven't even talked about the book. And I want to get to that. And for all the people who are listening, I want to let you know that you can ask questions by tweeting me at Mike Now, or right on Facebook, go to The Mike Novak Show, and we will take a look at your questions if you've got them about veggies in small spaces. And other questions, one of the things I happen to know about Kate is that she's an herb expert, because I was to her backyard when you were in Indiana, and I tell that story Kate, you should know. Okay, before we break here, I'm gonna bust Kate a little bit.
Uh-oh, Kate.
Kate Copse. For those people who want to write to her, and it's spelled KateCopsey. The book is The Downsized Veggie Garden. But back in 2004.
Gosh, was it that long ago?
Yes, it was. So we're talking a dozen years ago. Kate hired me for my first garden talk ever. All right. So here I've been doing radio for like 7 years and still considered myself pretty much a novice. And she invites me down. She says, you got to talk to the Indianapolis Master Gardeners. I'm like, okay. And she's gracious. She lets me stay at her house. We get up early on a Saturday. We drive through the fog and the mist to this conference of Master Gardeners. And I am shaking in my boots. Okay, I am just so scared. And I get out there and I do this talk about, well, you know, I'm not a fan of chemicals and you should try to find a way to do this if you can without all that nasty stuff. And my 45 minutes, I have like about 25 minutes of material and I'm done. And then the woman who's on after me is the Rosarian. Who's got like 787 roses in her garden and sprays them all every day with anything she can get, any chemical she can get her hands on. And it's explaining how you need these chemicals. Otherwise, your roses are going to look terrible. It was kind of an out-of-body experience, I have to admit, for me. It was sort of a baptism of fire there, mm-hmm. Kate. I've come a long way since then. I have to admit that I'm more secure in my convictions, and I have more facts to back me up. But it was really remarkable going down there, and I thank you for getting me started. You don't know what you unleashed upon the public.
I think actually you started with, how you killed plants, if I remember right.
Yeah, that's probably true. And the gardeners had to be wondering, who is this guy and why is he here? Yeah, I am a plant killer. It does happen. And lots of people kill plants. If you grow plants, you're going to kill plants. All right. Yeah. So hang on. As I said, contact us at the Mike Novak Show or on Twitter or on email. Mike@MikeNovak.net. I try to get to all of this as I can. I'm juggling screens here as we do every Sunday. And we will be back with Kate Copse, author of The Downsized Veggie Garden, right after I tell you, well, here's a common thing. You're a gardener, and you've heard over and over again about how important it is to help our pollinators by putting native plants in your garden. And yet, you really haven't figured out how to make the switch. It's a little intimidating, right? You can never find the plants that you want, and you'd like some advice to go with those little blue stems, wouldn't you? Fear no more. Natural Communities Native Plants is here. And you can get them online at Natural Communities. Well, you can get the natives online at naturalcommunities.net. Natural Communities Native Plants are locally grown and sourced, featuring more than 150 species native to the Chicago region. They have convenient online shopping and mail delivery, but they also appear at local green events where you can get those questions answered. For instance, next Saturday, May 7th, Nick Fuller from Natural Communities Native Plants, you might remember he was on the show the other week, will be selling natives at the Conservation Foundation's McDonald Farm, 10 South 404 Knock Knowles Road, or is that Knock Knowles Road, in Naperville, from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. if you can't be there. Get more information about plant sales at naturalcommunities.net. We will be right back with more of the Mike Novak Show on Q4 Radio, 1680 a.m.
It's not just your garden. It's the way you live. And there's so much to know. But you have help. Bonnie Plants. Now with Bonnie's app, Homegrown, you can learn about veggie and herb varieties, track and record your garden with photos and notes, share on Facebook and Twitter, and so much more. How'd you ever grow without it? Get Homegrown with Bonnie Plants for iPhone and Android. The more you know, the better you can grow with Bonnie.
Trying to weather the housing market? Consider replacing your windows and siding. Remodeling Magazine says they're some of the nation's most popular projects today.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for all your remodeling and energy needs. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
Did you know Chicagoans are getting healthier all the time? Hi, I'm Peggy, and I know this is true because for 6 years I've been publishing Natural Awakening, Chicago's greenest and healthiest magazine. And if you want your message to reach this growing market, you do need to get your business in front of our readers. Why? Because our advertisers tell us that our targeted readers are committed to improving their health and ready to take action. That's more than 80,000 people in Chicagoland who will respond to your message. They're looking for holistic wellness practitioners, integrative doctors and dentists, nutritionists, health coaches, yoga instructors, even home improvement and landscape experts. Natural Awakenings is a free monthly magazine available in more than 1,100 locations throughout Cook, Lake, and McHenry counties. Call me today to expand your market and grow your business. 847-858-3697. That's 847-858-3697. Natural Awakenings. Feel good, live simply, laugh more.
Everybody sing.
There ain't nothing in the world that I like better than bacon and lettuce and homegrown tomatoes. Up in the morning, out in the garden. Get you ripe when you don't get a heart.
Yeehaw.
Plant them in the spring, eat them in the summer. All winter without them's a culinary bummer. I forget all about the sweating and digging. Every time I go out and pick me
two,
a
two, three, four.
Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What'll I be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes.
Yeah. I can't think of better words of wisdom than homegrown tomatoes, and you can do them pretty much anywhere, according to Kate Copsey, who's the author of a new book called The Downsized Veggie Garden. Kate, you know, tomatoes are what everybody wants to grow. So, well, actually, we'll get to the tomato part because we talked a little bit about that already. Let's get to the book part, which is how you put this together and what were you hoping to accomplish with your book?
Well, I was hoping maybe to encourage people, maybe, you know, because we went from 3 acres to an acre, you know, some of the things in containers and things like that, and there are such neat ones out there that people don't know about. And, you know, if you go on that square foot garden type idea, if you've got a decent size container, you can put a tomato with some marigolds around. You can grow some of these eggplants, like Fairy Tale is an eggplant that is quite a small one. But, you know, if there's only two of you, because the kids that went off to college aren't there any longer, you know, you can still grow. But there's also a lot of people, maybe when the kids have gone off and they're downsizing and they're retiring, they haven't actually had time to do any gardening. And now they're starting again and they think, ooh, I'd like to jump on that bandwagon and go and get that tomato. And you know, and you're right, you know, going outside and being able to pick a raspberry or a tomato or even one of those pods of peas that you can just kind of nibble as you go around the garden, it's just great. I mean, sort of 30 seconds old is when you really get the nutrients and the taste, and makes walking around the garden at 6:30 in the morning worthwhile.
I don't know anybody who gets up that early. Certainly not in my household. But you said you went from 3 acres to an acre. But come on, Kate, I've never even had a quarter acre. I did have a quarter acre when I had a house out in the Pacific Northwest, but it wasn't a gardening quarter acre. Most people have, like, my city lot, 25. Mine's like 25 by 50 because I got a garage in the back. All right. And half of that is useless because I got a northern exposure on the house, so it shades that part of the yard. And people have even less. And you point this out in your book, which is some people only have a patio. Some people only have a balcony. But yes, you're saying that you can still make those work.
Oh, yes. I mean, our eldest down in Atlanta, I mean, they've got about a quarter acre, I think. They've just brought their first new house. And bless him, he took me out to the back garden, which was bathed in sunlight and grass. And he said, "Do you think we could put a garden in here, Mum?" And I said, "Uh-huh." And the other in-laws were doing the painting, and it was a beautiful day. I thought, that's a waste of time. So he pointed me to the little commercial area, and I came back a couple of hours later and assembled a little raised bed, which is in the book. I mean, from start to finish, we had a 4x4 raised bed, complete with a half a dozen different lettuces and a few herbs, in less than 2 hours. That was it.
Wow. And it can be that simple. Basically, you're talking, figure out the container, get some potting medium. And I think that's where people get hung up, is the potting medium. What am I going to plant stuff in? And you actually walk people through that in the book. Tell me about how you advise them to pick soil. How do they create the soil for their planters if they've got planters?
I think if you've got a planter, I mean, the most important thing would be to have it. If you can't really put garden soil in, because that's too heavy and it's got contaminants possibly and rocks, and you don't want that. Many of us have clay of various sorts, or in my case, just pure sand. It's a sand pit. So I mean, just go to the store and get a decent couple of bags of compost or potting mix. Add in a little bit of perlite or vermiculite, like, to keep that the lightness of the soil, and then that can be used to fill the container. If you're doing a 4x4 bed, you might want to put some peat moss in there as well, and a little, and about 30% peat moss, 30% vermiculite, and the rest of it just various composts and things.
Yeah, and there are that whole question of what to get at the store. I have people have asked me that for years. Because there's unfortunately, and you know this, Kate, especially at the box stores, there's a lot of junk. There's a lot of junk in bags. And what you need to do is find a product that you're comfortable with. Now, here in the Midwest, for instance, there are a number of companies that I like who make good potting mixes and manures, blended manures, that sort of thing. Midwest Ground Covers is one of them. Purple Cow Organics is another. And there are places like that. You know, and you need to ask, too. If you're not sure, don't go to a box store and ask. Go to your local independent garden center and ask. And just talk to somebody there and say, what do you guys like? What product do you think is really, really good? What's going to work well in a container for me? And
make sure it's organic as well.
Exactly. Well, and I'll tell you one other thing. Make sure it is. And this is a trend that I find disturbing and not very helpful, is that companies like Miracle-Gro now put fertilizer in with those mixes. And they say, we're going to save you some time. I'm not a fan of that. I don't want you to put fertilizer in. I'll do that myself. Thank you very much. So I'm always looking for potting mixes that do not have fertilizer. And you need to look on the bag to see if there's fertilizer included. If you don't want that, I suppose if you do want that, that's an easy way to go. But if you're not sure if it's in there, again, local independent garden center, bring over one of the employees, say, is there fertilizer in this mix? And they will know. They'll say, yeah, it is. There is, or there isn't. And you can say, well, give me a mix that doesn't have fertilizer. Or again, if that's what you want, buy it. But I'm not a fan of that. I'd rather, because I can go off and I can buy any organic fertilizer I want. The problem with the Miracle-Gro is that it's synthetic fertilizer that they put in there. And I want an organic, so I'm going to go get a Dr. Earth or an Espoma or something, and I'm going to add that to my mix. And there are people who use fish oils. There are people who use different kinds of fertilizers for their veggies that are different from the synthetics. So, yeah, you do you feel the same way, Kate?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, if you've got different composts and things in there, the nutrients from the plants that decompose, they're still there. I mean, alfalfa, for instance, if you get a source of that, or seaweed and that type of thing, you know, but all the different components of a compost. But one of the best fertilizers, actually, that that I come across lately are those little compost tea bags. I mean, it used to be to make compost tea, which has all the nutrients of compost, you had to have one a compost pile. And then you'd go and get the shovel and you'd put a shovel full into a bucket and you add water, and then you've got an aerator and you put a lid on it and you wait 6 weeks or something and then decant it and you've got compost tea. Well, then somebody came up and said, "Ooh, that's hard work. Let's make a compost tea bag." So now you just fill the bucket with water, throw in a tea bag next morning, take the tea bag out and water the plants. Duh. I mean, how simple can it be? And you get all the nutrients again. I mean, it's probably not quite as good, but, you know, it's easy to do.
The other thing, and you alluded to this earlier, in your planting, you like the square foot gardening approach. And I have interviewed Mel Bartholomew on my program a couple of years ago. He came on, and he's been doing this a long time, as you pointed
out. Oh, yes. Yeah. Mel is great.
He is interesting. And he started this in like 1981. And the idea is some people are intimidated by growing vegetables because they think of farmers, and farmers do it in rows, and they have all this space in between. And Mel came along and said, "You don't need all that space. They do it for convenience, and partly because they're growing, rows and rows of the same crop. You're growing different things. You can pack them all together in square foot boxes." And this is what you point out in your book. Explain that a little bit.
Well, I think when Mel's an engineer, and when he retired, from what I remember, you know, gardening is not really a downsized version of farming, really. you know, if you look even now, the back of the seed packet for peas, for instance, or maybe beans, you know, you go along the row and you put all the peas or the lettuce seeds or the cabbage seeds, and then they get their first true set of leaves, and then you look at it and you think, oh, they should all be three inches apart. So let's go and snip out all the ones that are in the middle so we've got that spacing. Well, Mel said, the equivalent of, if you only want to put six lettuce plants down, just put six seeds in. You know, why put a whole row of closely packed seeds and then take half of them out or two-thirds of them out when you only want six in the first place? And just put six in, because they germinate. You know, you get six germinated and they'll be there that 3 inches apart. And I mean, that just saves so much time.
Yeah.
You know, you can just pop them in. And, you know, if you only want six cabbages, just plant six cabbage seeds, you know, at a right space apart. You know, maybe 50 years ago, the germination rates weren't quite as stable. But I mean, today, if you put a tomato seed in, it's likely to germinate. And the same with the cabbages and everything else. Possibly exception being celery, which takes a phenomenal amount of time to germinate.
Well, yeah. Well, I found that carrots are a little tricky, too. You have to keep them constantly moist. And you can have – I've had failures and I've had successes with carrots. But on your porch, it's going to be a little easier to monitor the watering. You know, it's like watering your lawn with a carrot seed. You want to keep that moist, so you just sprinkle a little bit as the thing is until the thing germinates. It's like seeding your lawn. You just want enough moisture to get the seed to germinate, but you have to do it constantly, and it has to be wet the whole time. And then once it's done and it's germinated and it's growing, then you can water more deeply so that the plant actually chases the water down and grows deeper.
Yes.
Now, I got to ask you something. I just haven't opened the book to the whole vertical growing thing, which is, you know, you grow plants on your wall and up a trellis and things like that. Now, it's one thing to have beans growing up a trellis, but it's quite another to have those little pouches you hang. I'm afraid, Kate, I think that's gimmicky. Okay? Prove me wrong, okay?
Well, the ones that I like, I mean, the My Garden Post one, which is the very upright one, the base ones of those are about a square foot across the top, and they're about 8, 10, maybe 12 inches deep. So those are really deep, perfect for tomatoes or even some of the small squash plants. And then as you go up, they're slightly smaller. So I use those for the lettuce. Actually, I've got carrots in one of those, just
really?
A few carrot seeds.
Okay.
Yeah, and that one, I mean, it's got a two square foot footprint, which means that you can grow a lot in a vertical space, and it's very stable. The other ones I like are those ones that sit, the gaily coloured ones that you sit on the railing of the deck, because, again, those have the depth that you can accommodate a tomato as well as some of the other things that you want, and it's easy to clean. And I like the smart pots too. I shouldn't forget those, because those are economical. They're the right size. The roots get pruned on the outside. My mint loves it. And then of course the real basic one. Forget the pot altogether. And if you've got a good potting mix, just put a cross on the top, a few holes in the bottom, and plant. Boop.
There you go. Now, is there a trick though when you're doing that vertical gardening? And it's got a small amount of soil. How much more frequently do you need to water that?
Well, anything in a container, you're going to have to water probably more than you would have to water a garden. But I put up a drip irrigation system along the deck railing, which if you go to the box store, don't look for it in the garden section, you go to the plumbing section. The fact that it's for gardens is not relevant. It's in plumbing. So I got a little kit and I just strung that. My garden post comes with its own irrigation system. It's got little, you thread it up through the middle and it works quite nicely. And you attach it to a timer and everything got watered at 7 o'clock in the morning for half an hour. And I didn't really need to do very much else. I did put it on sometimes in the afternoon because you're watering the soil. It's not an overhead one. So, you know, you're not likely to get those problems with the sun being on them too much.
And can we put to rest the idea that growing tomatoes upside down is a good thing?
Well, if the only thing you can do is for a tomato is to hang it from the roof, I mean, they do work.
Okay, maybe I'm wrong.
It worked for me.
Really?
Yes.
I consider it gimmicky also.
I've grown tomatoes, eggplants, cucumbers upside down. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I withdraw the comment.
Well, what's nice if you have a brick wall? Because that warms up the area.
That would offset some
of the wind.
But from what I understand, I guess it would depend on the tomatoes. What kind of tomatoes did you grow, Peggy?
Smaller ones.
Yeah. Because you're not going to grow a big one, because what happens is those tomato plants for the big ones, they need a big root mass, and those roots can get huge in the ground, and there's just no room for that in one of those little bags.
Yeah, more the smaller patio, some of the determinants, Romas worked well. Like I said, eggplants. But they did require a lot more water, and you had to keep adding more soil as well.
I think one of the other things, before I let you go, Kate, that you do very well in the book is you talk about succession planting, which is the idea that you plant something in the spring, you know, and let's face it, you're talking about limited space, so you want to get the most out of it. So you plant something in the spring, the crop comes up, you harvest it, then you plant something else in its place, and then that's for the summer, and then you can go back for the fall and plant some of the same stuff you did in the spring and make great use of a very small space.
Oh, yes. I mean, succession planting, you know, with things, you obviously don't you want to do it with things like carrots and things. You know, just put a few out every couple of weeks so that you've got that the harvest all the way through the summer. But when your peas, we talked earlier about the peas wilting at 80 degrees, maybe when it's, you know, you're getting that towards that stable 80 degrees summer, you know, just put the bean seeds down already where the peas were, and the peas will shade the seeds as they start to germinate, and then you just trim off the peas and let the beans come up, so that, and then you reverse that towards the fall, and if you put lettuce behind them, the lettuce will get shaded so that it you know, you might eke out over the summer, on most summers, you might eke out a little bit of lettuce behind them too. So that's it. The other thing that we talk about, which most container gardens and small gardens don't talk about, is that crop rotation, which is really difficult in a 4x4. Because as you say, particularly if it's only maybe 8 inches deep, the roots of a tomato, particularly if you've got a mat underneath it or something, they will go across. And you know, you can maybe get away with the far corner for the next year, but then the third year, I recommend going to a container so that you've got that, you stop all those nematodes and the nasties getting it. You've got to have that rotation in as well as succession planting.
Yeah, and it's a lot easier actually if you've got a container, because then you just empty out the soil you used last year, clean the container, put in fresh soil, and you're not worrying about the diseases moving into your plants from one season to the next, right?
That's right. And of course, though, with peas and beans, you need to follow those maybe with a tomato, because you've got that added nitrogen from the legumes, and, you know, put that down. And if towards the end of the year, you know, if you've got your carrots and lettuce and kales already up and pretty much mature, you stick a nice little cover over the top of it. I was harvesting lettuce in January in Toledo in the snow. And Nikki Jabor did the great book on the year-round vegetable gardener.
Yes.
And she was the one that got me starting it. It really does work.
And there's this woman up in Canada, Growing North. I don't know if you're familiar with her. She's doing a lot of that stuff too, on the shores of Lake Superior. So it can be done. There's a lot to be grown in the winter and leading up to the winter and coming out of the winter that you can take advantage of if you're just careful. Kate Copsey, author of The Downsized Veggie Garden. You can go to my website, mikenovak.net. I've got more information there. I have the link to the page, but, you know, you can Google it anywhere, The Downsized Veggie Garden. Kate, it is always a pleasure to have you on the program. Much success to your book. I hope it's doing well.
Oh, it is. And thank you so much for inviting me to be on your program. I'm glad your voice is much better.
All right. Take care, Kate. I'll talk to you soon.
Okie dokie. Okay. Thanks, Mike.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Kate.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Did you know that Genesis is the Midwest's largest source of airbrush supplies? Find out more at ChicagoAirbrushSupply.com or ArtSupply.com. Or stop into their showroom at 2525 North Elston and say that you heard about them on Q4 Radio. Get an extra 10% off their already discounted prices all month long. Genesis, Chicago's only privately owned art supplier, serving all of Chicago's artistic framing and drafting needs since 1946.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the thought of summer, delightful. Actually, the good news about our spring so far is that if you're a gardener, you can't complain that you've missed anything yet. So now's the time to pick up a copy of the May-June issue of Chicagoland Gardening Magazine and get ready for the sun to shine and the birds to warble. In this issue, my buddy Nina Koziel gives you a quick lesson on tomatoes, and don't put them out there yet or they'll just sulk. I'll bet you didn't know that there are determinate and indeterminate types. To find out which is which and which you want, pick up a copy of the magazine, or you might grab it because of my column on the inside back page, but I've lawyered up, so don't blame me for anything you read there. Chicagoland Gardening Magazine, a publication of state-by-state gardening magazines. Go to chicagolandgardening.com, but if you're in other parts of the Midwest or the South, try one of the 21 magazines in those regions by going to statebystategardening.com or call 888-265-3600, 888-265-3600. You're listening to the Mike Novak Show on Q4 Radio, 1680 AM. The second big hour begins right after this.
Captain's log, stardate 42326.1. The Enterprise is under attack by an apparently hostile life form. Mr. Worf, status report.
Inexplicable, Captain. They appear to be perambulating vegetables. We are being stalked by stalks of asparagus.
That is incorrect, Mr. Worf. Asparagus officinalis, or killer asparagus, was the subject of a very popular 21st century tome by the brilliant author Mike Novak.
Mike Novak. I'm familiar with his work.
Mike Novak was one of the smartest, funniest people in the horticultural world of the 21st century.
Sound red alert. Shields up. Tell me more, Mr. Data.
He has been variously compared to Mark Twain, Dave Barry, and Edgar Allan Poe.
Edgar Allan Poe, author of my favorite children's stories.
Captain, I am attempting to access a copy of the masterpiece. It seems to be available online at aroundtheblockpress.com.
Aroundtheblockpress.com. Aroundtheblockpress.com. Yes, Mr. Watt.
Yes, Captain. Aroundtheblockpress.com.
How many times can I say it?
I didn't come here looking for Jesus. I brought him along with me.
Well, it didn't it rain. God's gonna send the water from Zion. It's gonna raise his heaven up high. It's gonna rain. Well, it's gonna rain.
Welcome back to the Mike Novak Show, still Chicago's only locally broadcast deep green gardening and environment program. Broadcasting live every Sunday from the Genesis Art Supply Building on North Elston Avenue on Q4 Radio and at MikeNovak.net. Here he is again, Mike Novak.
All right. Welcome back to the second hour of the Mike Novak Show. And in the studio, and let me get his mic up here, and I'm very happy to have attorney Albert Ettinger. Albert, good morning.
Good morning.
Whoop, wait. I'm not. Oh, it would help if I did. Let me try that. Try that again.
Good morning.
There we are. It's been a technical circus here this morning. Albert, I got to tell you about the response that I got. I posted last night on Facebook that I was going to have you on the show. And usually I post these things ahead of time. I get a few people that look at it and go, oh, that's interesting. I'll get, you know, Facebook tells you how many people your post has reached. And usually it's, I don't know, 20, 30. I got 1,041 people reached on this post last night, which tells me that folks are paying attention to this issue. And I got comments and people going, what's going on? And that's the reason we're having this conversation today, is because this all started for me more than 4 years ago when I got notice about, and I forget who contacted me, somebody from LaSalle County, and said, hey, they're going to put a open pit frack sand mine next to Starved Rock. You got to do something. And it has been covered somewhat in the local media here in Chicago, certainly down there. What happened is Mississippi Sand LLC, first of all, they applied for this, and the county board said, yeah, go ahead. And then they had to go through the IDNR, the Illinois Department of Natural Resources, and they okayed it. And then people like you and Open Lands and Prairie Rivers Network and Illinois Sierra Club stepped up and said, well, not so fast. You guys didn't do this exactly the way you're supposed to by the book, and so we're going to take you to court. So it dragged on in the courts for about 4 years. And then I run into you at Good Food Festival, and you say, we lost. And I said, what? Huh? So I started looking to see what kind of coverage there was in the media about this case and the disposition of this case, and I found nothing. I mean, not just me going on Google, but Kathleen went and did her own searches. She's an educational writer, so she has access to various libraries and stuff, and she just went online, found nothing. Why is that? Why is nobody covering this? Why isn't anybody interested in the outcome of this court case?
Well, I'm a lawyer. I'm not a media person, so I can't really tell you why the media covers and doesn't cover things.
Okay.
I've got a number of things that I think are very important that I can't get the Tribune to cover or I can't get radio to cover. So I can't really tell you that. I will say, though, that it was an Illinois appellate court decision. It didn't hit any of the real hot media buttons. It didn't touch on, transgender restrooms or abortion or something yeah. like that that really captivated. Donald Trump did not speak to this issue. So that's all I can really tell you.
Okay. Well, you know, and I'm not expecting you to have the answers to why it's not covered. I mean, it makes me crazy. And I think Cindy might be there. Cindy, are you there?
Yeah. Sorry, Mike. As I anticipated, the rain yesterday blew out my home line. Glad I'm giving you the second number.
I'm glad you gave it to me, too. And so much for landlines, huh? This is why everybody's yes. got a cell phone now. Cindy Skruckrud is the Clean Water Program Director for the Illinois chapter of the Sierra Club. And the first question I asked Albert Ettinger, and by the way, he's an environmental attorney. He has worked for the ELPC, the Environmental Law and Protection Center. The first question I asked Albert, and maybe you have a little more insight into this, Cindy, because you're out there working with folks, is why is this not being covered by anybody? Why is this story not a story? I mean, there was coverage when it was in the courts and being held up in the courts, and now that there's been a resolution of the case, I have not seen a single word about it. Except, you know, I'm the first one, as far as I know, on this show right now.
Well, yeah, I guess, Mike, it probably that, you know, there's one thing is with the oil and gas business in decline, prices, you know, at record lows, we're seeing a slowdown in the potential for fracking that a number of years ago, we were hearing, oh, we're going to have all this fracking for oil and gas going on in Illinois. That's not happening. And so, likewise, I think we've seen a slowdown in mining of sand. And the thing about LaSalle County is it's blessed with these wonderful sandstone formations that draw everyone there to places like Starved Rock State Park. But that same sand formation is also made up of a type of sand that's ideal to use in fracking operations. So, you know, that's, I would say, you know, oil and gas prices were just, you know, we haven't seen any mining go on at this site next to Starved Rock State Park. Not to say that we haven't had many other new mine proposals in the LaSalle County area.
Yeah,
Mississippi Sand proposed this one.
That's true, Cindy. I've been talking to Ashley Williams, who's an activist from the area. She's now studying environmental law at Loyola, and she's become part of the team for the Mike Novak Show. And she says things have slowed down considerably in LaSalle County. There's various companies. Some appear possibly to have gone out of business. Others are selling their interests. The actual mining is way down. And, you know, as you mentioned, it's a function of the market having tanked for oil. So, and it moves up the chain. If you're not fracking as much, you don't need as much sand for fracking. And so things have quieted down. But, you know, if you look at history, these things run in cycles, and there will be boom again following this bust. So
yep.
Those folks aren't out of the woods yet. And when I say they're not out of the woods, it's because that open frack sand mining is a threat to their quality of life. I've been there. I've been hit in the face with the silica sand. I know what it's like. And I can't imagine walking out your door every morning and have that happen. And some of these homes are surrounded. They have been abandoned almost. I mean, they're not abandoned. They're surrounded by different mining interests. So there'll be this little strip of land that'll be in between these mines. What are those folks supposed to do? And they can't get anything. They can't get market value for those homes. So they're stuck. And this is just an example of what's going on in that community. And
I think that, you know, this is an issue that LaSalle County is, I think, really struggling with, in that they've had a long history of sand mining in the that area of the state, you know, for 100 years.
Right.
But not at the rate at which, you know, a few years back we were seeing proposals for new mines and, you know, just the rush to get more mines established and, you know, and dig this stuff out and ship it off to all parts of the country for fracking operations. So this, I think this, you know, certainly, I think you're right, Mike, that we need to be aware of what's potentially coming in the future, but having this little breathing room is I think, a good opportunity for folks in the county to kind of really rethink, you know, what's most important to their future in terms of, you know, it's Starved Rock State Park is the most visited park in the state. And
right.
Certainly tourism is very important in that county.
2 million plus visitors per year. So let's go back to Albert Ettinger here in the studio and talk about that case that the environmental groups brought against, was it against IDNR? Or Mississippi Sand?
The primary defendant was IDNR. Mississippi Sand was also a defendant.
Okay. And what was your basic contention about what they had done in making their decision to allow frack sand mining there?
Well, go back to your earlier question a little and then answer your first question. Part of the reason, I think a major reason why we didn't get much publicity about this is that we lost the case on grounds that had nothing to do with whether or not IDNR gave out the permit properly. We were basically dismissed on the basis that we didn't have any business being there, to use a common term rather than the
so it was never, it was standing.
It was standing. We never got to the merits.
You know, if you listen to back where I used to work at WCPT, there's a guy on the air called Norman Goldman, and he's a lawyer. He talks about standing all the time and points out that that is often a reason why cases get thrown out of court is because people do not have standing.
Yeah, and it's a problem because it's part of what makes lawyers boring is that we have to talk about these procedural issues all the time. But the fact of the matter is if you never get to talk about the real issue, which is whether or not IDNR did its job and made sure that this mine was not going to result in sand blowing in people's faces in the state park and was not going to result in economic damage to the community and was not going to do these bad things, we never got to any of those issues.
Oh, my goodness.
Those were the issues we wanted to talk about, but we never got to them because of a very strange set of properties of Illinois law that kept us from even asking the court to look at whether or not DNR had done its job. And that I think is the – that's the – you know, it's not a very exciting takeaway message. You know, citizens attempt to get the law enforced and they don't get in the door. It's much more interesting, I would hope, to look at the real merits of the case, but we never got that far. We got doors slammed in our face.
All right. Well, if you don't have standing, and I assume that – and I looked at the believe it or not, I read through the your summary of the case that you sent me. I'm not a lawyer, but what I got out of it was that the whole issue was standing. But if you don't have standing, and this these environmental groups, who does have standing?
No one.
What? Well, we can, the citizens of Illinois minute. Can't speak for themselves.
Well, let's explain the situation. What the court basically says. Now, this isn't true of all laws. Laws differ. On a Clean Water Act permit, for example, which I deal with a lot, if we're not happy with that permit, we can appeal to the Pollution Control Board, and then if we're not happy with what the Pollution Control Board did, we can go to the Illinois Appellate Court through that process. And in fact, that's what we just did as to the Water Reclamation District's permit. And we won. Can't do that under this statute or under a lot of Illinois statutes. The first big case that came out this way was a case involving CAFOs, these massive
right.
hog operations, mainly in Illinois, massive hog operations put out. If you want to talk about disgust, we're you know, that's is about as good as you can get for disgusting. The citizens who wanted to appeal a permit given by the Illinois Department of Agriculture couldn't do so because they lacked standing under the decision involved there. It's the same situation here. What the court's basically saying is you can't sue, you can't ask the court to look at whether the agency did the job because there's only two parties who to the proceedings, to the permit proceedings. The only two parties are the permit applicant and the department. Well, the department's not going to appeal from its bad decision, and the permit applicant, obviously, is happy it's got a permit. So no one can challenge the decision whatsoever. Period.
That's positively Orwellian.
Yeah, this is a huge concern to us if we're going to, we're not able to even be involved in this discussion. And so the instances that Albert's talked about are just examples of the way that citizen involvement is limited in those cases and potentially similar cases in the future that will run up against the same problem.
We have, for instance, the law, the basic law as to whether DNR was supposed to give this permit. There were 13 things they were supposed to look at. They did a very poor job or no job at all as to 13 of the things they were supposed to look at before they gave out this permit. But it didn't matter because nobody was in a position to complain about it. Basically, following the law was optional for DNR because there was nobody in a position to complain about it. Now, if they'd gone the other way and denied a permit or that the industry thought that they deserved a permit that they didn't get, well, they can appeal. But the public concerned about the permit, they are, well, I won't use the common term, but there's no, they are.
I know what they are. They're screwed. All
yeah,
right?
They're out of luck.
Yeah.
So that's the asymmetry in a lot of Illinois laws, particularly to do, well, with this one, with CAFOs. I'm not going to itemize them all because I don't necessarily want to reveal all of our vulnerabilities here, but you get the idea is that there's something fundamentally wrong with Illinois law here on a number of key statutes.
So is there any recourse at the moment? Can you appeal this decision?
No. I mean, we did appeal to the Illinois Supreme Court, or actually we filed a petition for leave to appeal as the formal term, and that was denied. So as of right now, it's over.
We took it as far as we can. We appealed it. We appealed it all the way up to the Supreme Court.
So essentially, the law, that case is over. They've got the permits they need to do what they want to do. If they start mining, there's some other places they want to expand to. They may need other permits. Also, of course, we have a legislature and we can change the law. But other than that, no, the game is over. The fat lady has sung.
Wow, that's just unbelievable. It sounds to me then what you're dealing with in the future is you got to change the law. But I imagine that, given the...
In our state, yeah.
Right, the General Assembly and the fact that it can't even pass a budget, and it doesn't seem as though... Well, there's some really good people in the General Assembly when it comes to environmental matters. I'm not gonna deny that. But I can't imagine there are enough to change what seems to be a fairly arcane law at the moment, right, Albert?
Well, I don't know if it's arcane. It's something that's a fact of my life that a lot of us have had to deal with in terms of this inability to use the law to compel the agencies to follow the law. It looks a little grim right now in the legislature. Obviously, industry and other people who want permits are happy with things the way they are right now. It will be a difficult amendment to get through the legislature. Even in the best of times, it would be tough. But as you point out, these are not the best of times as far as the Illinois State Legislature goes.
Go ahead.
I was going to ask, is there ways to work through IDNR to get them to be more thorough in the permitting process, since you had said they shortcut this one?
Well, We tried. Actually, Cindy tried more than I did. I got brought in later. We filed a petition. We asked DNR to look at various things, and they did not do so. I'm a lawyer. I'm using legal tools. Mm-hmm. There are political tools. Increased publicity, increased political pressure, things like that can be important. For one thing, you pointed out the LaSalle County Board was against us on this one, or they were in favor of
right.
Obviously, the voters of LaSalle County have something to say about that.
Mm-hmm.
It's my understanding they've already said some things, and the LaSalle County Board might not have acted the way it acted then, now.
Yeah, there's been a lot of pressure. And in the neighboring communities as well. I mean, Utica and Ottawa, and there's annexations going on. I mean, it almost, for a period there, beginning around 2011 through about 2013, it was something new every week, a new sale, a new annexation, and the sand mines were popping up all over the place, and then everything crashed. Which thank goodness, for one thing, I don't give a darn if the oil prices go down and that business collapses. Maybe it'll encourage us to actually get some renewable energy going. But it's been good for the people of LaSalle County because a lot of this activity has slowed down. But it takes us back to the whole IDNR question, and that's part of our problem. IDNR is not. And I've been watching this for a number of years. To my way of thinking, certainly in this case, IDNR is part of the problem. They're not part of the solution. And that is because they are as schizoid as an agency can be. They are mandated to protect our natural areas and to exploit our natural areas at the same time. And the exploitation seems to win every time. And that's, me speaking as a radio guy in my observation. And there are other agencies that are a problem, too. You're talking about CAFOs, Concentrated Animal Feeding Operations. As far as I know, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, the Illinois Department of Agriculture has never said no to a CAFO.
That is my understanding.
Yeah. Are you listening, folks? Our Department of Agriculture has never said no to a massive animal breeding operation and everything that comes with it. Because I've had people from Illinois Citizens for Clean Air and Water on this program, Karen Hudson, and I'm going to have her back. She's talked about, the down in Springfield, near New Salem, they just lost that case. There's going to be a CAFO put up down the block from Lincoln's
birthplace.
Well, not
or
birthplace.
No,
young
home.
Adult
childhood
home.
Childhood home, yes.
Not childhood, but okay. Young adult home.
Indiana
New Salem.
Is the birthplace.
Right. Can't wait till the wind blows the wrong way down there and people say, well, what the heck is that? Well, that's your state government at work, is what it is.
Well, I've been working on Illinois environmental issues since 1982. I've worked as general counsel or as lawyers for the Sierra Club. Since 1982. And something you got to understand when you say schizophrenic is you're almost literally correct. The Illinois Department of Natural Resources was formed out of the merger of several other bodies, which although it happened 20 years ago, the merger never really happened. There was the Office of Mine and Minerals, the Office of Water, and the Department of Conservation. And conservation never felt that they could regulate because they were just there to put up pretty things and have state parks and things, and they were very unhappy about regulating. The Office of Mines and Minerals has always seen its job as promoting coal mining and promoting mining. And when they put those agencies together, you would have hoped that the combined DNR would have then taken its mission to protect natural resources seriously and change the culture of the Office of Mines and Minerals. But by and large, that hasn't happened. And so, yeah, you're almost exactly right with the schizophrenic. It's two minds that were stuck together and never wired properly.
Wow. Well, there's your answer in terms of legislation. And I said this for a couple of years. I think you got to separate them. You can't have the same agency advocating exploitation of resources and preservation of natural resources at the same time. I don't see how that happens. It would be better if they were two different agencies who battled it out, and let's see who wins. Are you skeptical about that, Albert?
Well, I'm not sure why we need an agency to promote CAFOs or why we need an agency to promote coal.
Okay, fine. Then get rid of it. Get rid of mines and minerals.
I guess I'm saying that all we need here is the regulatory function. We can count on capitalism to promote coal or not promote coal as it sees fit. We don't need the state government to get involved in that.
Okay, that's Albert Ettinger. He's an environmental lawyer. And you can go to albertettinger.com, E-T-T-I-N-G-E-R. On the phone, we have Cindy Skrukrud, who's the Clean Water Program Director for the Illinois chapter of the Sierra Club. Cindy, I need to bring in Merlin and Susan Dodd Calhoun, who live out in LaSalle County, right next to the area where this proposed frac sand mine is going up. I'm going to give you a chance to say a couple of words. I'm going to let you go, okay?
Okay.
You had a couple of things you wanted to bring up that are going on. I know you participated in a migratory bird function today, but you've also got some other stuff coming up, right?
Yeah. So just a couple of quick things. So we've been celebrating International Migratory Bird Day up at the Hackmatack National Wildlife Refuge, which is a new refuge on the Illinois-Wisconsin border up in McHenry County. And so we've got activities this afternoon related to International Migratory Bird Day from noon to 4 at Volo Bog, so encourage people to head out there. And then next Saturday, May 7th, from 9 to 4, the Madewin National Tall Grass Prairie is holding a special event called the Madewin Bison Expedition, and that's we've got new bison, a herd of buffalo out at Madewin as of last fall. And a lot of those cows came into the Illinois pregnant, and they're starting to have calves. And folks will be able to get out on May 7th, and they're going to try and herd them all into a corral that's kind of close to where folks can view them. And so encourage people to come out for that. You can't drive into Madewin that day. You need to head into Wilmington and Elwood, and there'll be shuttle buses that'll take people out to see the bison that day. So
how cool is that?
Very cool.
I think the kids especially, I'm sorry, not just the kids. I went out a couple of years ago out to the west and saw bison in the wild, and I was like, oh, look, there's bison. Look at so I think everybody finds that really, really cool. Cindy Skrukrud, thank you so much. We'll talk more, and maybe we can talk more about the bison at Madewin. That might be really fun.
Okay, great. Hey, well, good talking to you all this morning, and I'll get on and listen to Merlin and Susan and say hi to them for me.
Absolutely. Thanks, Cindy. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is the Mike Novak Show on Q4 Radio, 1680 AM. And we're talking about the frac sand mine rush in LaSalle County, which has slowed down. And to that end, I'm going to bring in, I believe that I have Susan Dodd Calhoun. Susan, are you there?
Yeah.
Is Merlin with you?
Yes, I am.
Okay, there. You know, it reminds me of like when I used to call Mom and Dad. And, you know, there would be Mom. She'd pick up the phone because Dad never wanted to. And you'd hear Dad in the background go, I'm here. you guys are basically on the front lines out in LaSalle County in terms of the Mississippi Sand LLC site. But there's been some development, news, going on there that you wrote to me about yesterday, Susan. Does either one of you want to explain what's going on right now?
Well, yeah. Earlier this year, we actually started seeing test drilling being done on the property. And to me, that indicated that, you know, they'd already done all their test drilling at Mississippi Sand had. So that indicated to me that they probably had, because of a, you know, slower sand use that they probably had either put it up for lease or for sale. And lately I have heard that they actually did put it up for sale, and that from what I understand, one of the other sand companies bought it. I believe it was U.S. Silica.
Okay, so there's still musical chairs going on out there right now with all these different companies.
Yes, there is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you live right next to the property. I mean, when I was out there a couple of years ago, about a year and a half ago, a number of the activists in the area took me on a tour of all the sand mines. Cindy mentioned that the mining operation started basically in the 1860s, 150 years ago. They showed me the first sand mine there. It's a lake, but it's not a lake you can access. It's a lake with a 50-foot drop, you know, and there's water at the bottom. And this is what happens. Although Mississippi Sand apparently had plans, and Albert, maybe you can confirm this, they were going to, once they were done with their operations, restore the land. Wasn't that part of the agreement?
That was part of the theory.
The theory.
It was never – that was one of the things we were complaining about. In fact, they didn't spell out how – in fact, they were going to do that. They were better at promising things than putting it in the permit.
And if you look at what's out there now in the various frack sand mines – and I got a photo of one on my Facebook page that I took. It looks like the Badlands. This is what they do. They turn this farmland into Badlands. Now, Merlin and Susan, you guys live right next door, so you've got to be happy that it sounds like, well, for one thing, you've got to be happy that it's been delayed 4 years because of the court case. That's got to be good for
you.
Oh,
yes.
Definitely.
I'm very happy about it. In fact, you know, I mean, I always understood that the court case, you know, I mean, the way the county was, the way that the DNR is, it might be really hard with the court case, but I always figured the longer we had, you know, like Cindy was saying, this is an industry that goes with the booms and busts. And I hoped, back in 2012, it was a boom. And I hoped the longer that we could put this off, that maybe there would be a bust. And you know, now maybe we have a few years, or maybe it never will happen because, you know, the industry might not bounce back.
Wouldn't that be lovely?
That would be.
Yeah. Tell us about your operation and how having a sand mine next door is going to affect you.
Well, you know, I mean, it's going to affect us personally because of the noise and the dust. I mean, when we drive home, there's a sand mine on our way home, and on windy days, it's like sandstorm. You know, it's amazing how much sand is blowing across the road. So we would be subject to that every day. We also have bees. We have quite a few beehives. We have a small beekeeping business. And we're concerned about what effect that would have, the sand would have on our honey, because that sand is going to get into the honey.
Well, and the overall health of the bees as well.
True.
Wow.
Because those small shards of sand, when the bees fly through it, I mean, it's just like, you know, it can cut them.
And it acts as a dehydrant as well.
And it can actually affect the bees.
Have you had anybody to check that, to see the actual damage to either the bees or the honey?
Well, at this point in time, you know, around us, bees actually will go about 2 to 3 miles in any direction to get nectar for the honey, and we really at this point in time don't have them that close. If Mississippi Sand or now U.S. Silica starts to have a mine here, then we'll start to have problems probably.
That's I hadn't even thought. See, there's all kinds of unintended consequences for an operation like this. I was thinking of the human aspect of it, but the idea of it being affecting bees never even occurred to me. So what are your plans right now? Sit and wait and see what happens?
That's pretty much all we can do right now, actually, I guess. You know, we can just hope, you know.
And support other people that are out there doing, you know, what we did a few years ago, such as Ashley Williams and whoever else, you know, steps up and starts maybe changing some of these laws and ordinances and what have you to make it a little more favorable for individuals such as myself and my husband, make it a more of a fair fight.
Well, okay, that's where we turn to Albert Ettinger here. How do you make this a fair fight? Is there any way to do it?
Well, yes. I mean, there are laws that say, in fact, that basically in federal law, if this had been a federal case and it had been a federal permit, there's a Federal Administrative Procedure Act that says that a party who is aggrieved by a government action can sue in the district court to have it reviewed. Now, and that doesn't mean, of course, that the district court makes the decision. Whatever the agency was makes the decision. But the district court looks at it and says, did they look at the right factors? Did they do their job? And then giving a lot of deference to whoever the agency is, they'll generally affirm it. But if the agency just blew it, as we believe they did in this case, they'll send it back and say, you didn't get that right, or you didn't look at the right factors. Go think about it some more. And we could certainly pass a law like that in Illinois. We just haven't. We have this other principle that says basically the permit applicant can complain, but nobody else.
That's insane. I'm sorry. There's got to be some recourse for average citizens. And I've already thought of my hashtag. My hashtag is FixIDNR. All right. And I think we ought to start spreading this hashtag, FixIDNR. And I'm going to tweet it out when we're finished. Or maybe you can do it. Peggy, but it's that kind of injustice that makes people's heads explode. Like me sitting here saying, "Well, we've got to be able to do something," and here's Albert, who's being very calm and who's been down this road many times, say, "Well, no, not really, not at the moment. We can work towards it, but it's really slow." And as you know, the wheels of justice grind slowly. But in the meantime, people like Merlin and Susan Dodd Calhoun, their futures are kind of put on hold. So, and they're not, and you guys aren't the only ones out there. There's other people who have the same issues. I've met them.
Yeah.
Well, definitely across the river. It's while it's quiet right now, the people that are still living over there still have to deal with the effects of what's being left over there unattended. And from what I understand, the blowing of the sand is so severe sometimes it's they can't even take their pets outside to walk around. And nothing, to my knowledge, is really being done, you know, to help these people in any way, shape, or form.
And we haven't even gotten to the idea that there are going to be 2 million visitors a year to Starved Rock State Park, and if all of this activity ramps up again, they're going to feel the same thing. They're going to get the silica dust. They're going to get in their cars, and they're going to go, "What's this stuff that's all over the inside of my car?" And they're going to stop coming.
Well, that was part of what that was part of what we were complaining about in the lawsuit that we hoped the court would look at, because one of the factors they're supposed to look at is the economics of the project. Well, DNR looked at the economics of the project from the point of view of the permit applicant, Mississippi Sand, and said, "Oh, they're going to employ these people. They're going to sell sand. That's wonderful." They didn't look at all about the visitors to the park or what this potential effect would be on the county of that economic effect. That was just not considered. So, you know, talk about – you wouldn't have to knock off the visitorship very much to Starved Rock State Park to totally blow away whatever economic advantage there was from developing this sand.
And we didn't even get into the idea that, you know, one of the things that the county board said is, "Oh, there's going to be jobs." As far as we can determine, there were fewer than 30. Merlin, do you want to explain why you're laughing about that?
That was me.
Oh, that's Susan. Okay, Susan.
But this area, you know, there's so many people from Chicago and from all over Illinois that come to Starved Rock. Myself, I go there walking once or twice a week, and when I'm there, the park is always full. There was about 2 weeks ago I went. It was a beautiful, nice day, and you couldn't find a parking spot anywhere. That's how many people were here. And just to think that 20 or 30 jobs will make up if you lose that flow of traffic coming into the park is just ridiculous.
But that's the point. That's the point I was going to make, 20 or 30 jobs. And they were saying, hey, we're going to have all these good-paying jobs, 20 to 30 jobs. That's as you said, versus the thousands and thousands of people who come to Starved Rock State Park. Not to mention, and we haven't even gotten into the wildlife.
Yeah.
And the effect the wildlife there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, there'd be adverse effects to it, definitely. You have to know that.
And Albert, that's
I wanted to say a few things on this, that what you referred to earlier. One of the things we pointed to was the bees, that was a business interest. I mean, the courts, let's face it, when it comes to things like aesthetic desires and the value of a walk in the park for a day, they have a hard time calculating things like that. It does not compute well. But when you can look at damage to a business like an apiary, that's something closer to what they're comfortable with. But we couldn't even get into that. Not even economics, not even the hard economics. I have to correct you on a few things.
Go ahead.
I love your hashtags, of course, but you haven't gone nearly far enough. You got the what was it? Reform DNR.
Fix IDNR.
Well, you got to do IDOT too. Department of Transportation. You got to do IDOA, the Department of Agriculture, which is handing out these hog facility permits like confetti. So you got a whole family of hashtags to put out.
Not to mention the governor's office.
Yes. So
fix Rauner.
Yeah, there's a lot of
neuter Rauner.
We won't go down that road.
Okay, sorry.
You mentioned that I'm calm. I'll just have to say I'm calm because A, I live in Chicago, but secondly, I'm calm because believe it or not, representing the Sierra Club, this is not the first case I've ever lost.
Yeah.
As I tell young lawyers and people going to law school who want to represent environmental groups, if you want to win a lot of cases, you should go on the other side. The polluters win a lot more cases than we do, but we do win from time to time, and I think we have, It requires a certain calmness and a certain attitude about life, because otherwise you'd go insane.
And on that note, I think that's a perfect way to end this conversation. Albert Edinger, environmental lawyer. Go to albertedinger.com. Merlin and Susan Dodd Calhoun, hang in there, you guys. Thank you so much for talking to me again. I'm going to post this. I'm going to make sure that this particular conversation has its own dedicated podcast so that you can send it to your friends and say, A, why isn't the media covering this? B, it's still ongoing. C, why haven't we fixed IDNR and IDOT and DOA? And on and on and on. And I hope that this will spread and we can get the word out. Sue Merlin and Sue, I hope I talk to you soon.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Before I let you go, can I actually just thank everybody, Sierra Club, Open Lands, everybody that
Prairie was involved.
Prairie Rivers. I mean, you people have actually given us, this should have happened in 2012. It's 2016 and they haven't broke ground, so thank you. You think you lost, but I think you won.
That's an excellent statement. I'm so glad to hear that. Okay, you guys, have a great Sunday.
Thank you.
You too.
Bye.
And Albert, thank you so much for coming down to the studio, our opulent studios here. And you and I need to talk again. I'd love to have you back on the program because I know you cover more than this issue. You're a very interesting fellow.
Well, that's kind of you to say. I was always afraid that calm, boring lawyers would be calm and boring.
Yeah.
But we'll go forward.
You're calm, boring, and insightful. So.
Hey, this is Peggy. When I speak at local events, people often ask me, aren't you the Peggy in the Natural Awakenings ads? And that makes me happy because it reminds me that Chicagoans want to live healthier lives. A Natural Awakenings magazine helps them do just that. Natural Awakenings, it's the greenest, healthiest magazine in the Chicago area. Each month, we bring you the latest information about health and wellness,
complementary medicine, fitness and exercise, raising healthy kids, and even healthy pets. You'll find articles about healthy homes, too, including gardening, energy efficiency, and green living. And if you love good food, you'll always find tasty recipes and cooking hints. Check out our monthly calendar. It's full of events to help keep you connected. Natural Awakenings is available in more than 1,100 locations throughout Chicago and suburban Cook, Lake, and McHenry counties. And it's free. Or visit us online at nachicagonorth.com. Natural Awakenings. Feel good. Live simply. Laugh more.
This is Heather Fry. Every time I open up an issue of Chicagoland Gardening Magazine, I know I'm going to learn something. And that's in spite of Mike Novak's column on the inside back page. If you've ever read it, you know what I'm talking about. Anyway, in Chicagoland Gardening, you might pick up some knowledge in one of the excellent feature articles, or in one of the regular departments like Ask the Garden Pros, or the Regional Reports, or What to Do in the Garden, or you might be inspired by one of the luscious photos. And Chicagoland Gardening Magazine is just one of 21 different publications of state-by-state gardening. Wherever you live in the Midwest or the South, State-by-State Gardening has a magazine for you. They feature articles by some of the leading gardening experts in each state, including famous authors, nursery owners, state extension agents, master gardeners, even Mike. Subscribe today by going to statebystategardening.com or call 888-265-3600. That's 888-265-3600.
It's not just your garden. It's the way you live. And there's so much to know. But you have help. Bonnie Plants. Now with Bonnie's app, Homegrown, you can learn about veggie and herb varieties, track and record your garden with photos and notes, share on Facebook and Twitter, and so much more. How'd you ever grow without it? Get Homegrown with Bonnie Plants for iPhone and Android. The more you know, the better you can grow with Bonnie.
Trying to weather the housing market? Consider replacing your windows and siding. Remodeling Magazine says they're some of the nation's most popular projects today.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for all your remodeling and energy needs. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
I get no time.
Wow, that was an amazing conversation with all parties involved, talking about the frac sand mining going on at Starved Rock State Park and in the county of LaSalle. I, like I said before, I'm going to put a dedicated podcast up with just that conversation, and I want people to spread it. This is important. People need to know about this stuff. And our dysfunctioning bureaucracy in Illinois.
I would guess most people don't even realize it.
No, they don't. They don't know what's going on. It's hard to keep track of everything. They know what the Donald said yesterday, but they don't know this, that there are people suffering from the effects of these mines. Rick DeMaio, meteorologist extraordinaire. Hey, happy birthday, dude.
Yeah, good morning, Mike. How are you?
Okay. You're not going to allow me to say happy birthday?
You can say that. That's fine.
you don't care, huh? You don't want to really acknowledge that, do you?
No, I'm fine with it. I mean, after a while, you just kind of like, yeah, it's a birthday. You know, it's one of those things that, you know, when people say, what do you want for a birthday? I just say, peace and quiet. That's what I want. That's what my mother used to say.
You know what
I want? My mother used to say, I just want, what's that?
No. I was just going to say, I want sunshine, you know, and I'm not a guy who complains about weather. I said this at the top of the show. I don't complain about weather much. Yesterday was one of the nastiest days I've experienced in a while.
It was slightly nastier than Wednesday, slightly nastier than last Friday. We've had a lot of those nasty days. And this is going down as the fifth cloudiest month on record. And that information comes from Frank Wachowski, who's a National Weather Service retired observer on the southwest side, and sends that information over to Scaling because he has one of those sunlight measurements or devices in his backyard. We don't really do that anymore, but he does it. And it, not only has it been cloudy, but, you know, the only way for it to be cloudy this time of year is if you have high degrees of moisture and a wind coming off the lake. And you combine all those three and you have just very uncomfortably I don't know if the word is nasty, but it seems like you get assaulted when you step outside, especially after you've had a couple of, you know, really nice days. You know, we had a couple of days in the 80s. We had an 83 on Monday. If you were away from the lake last Sunday, we were talking, it was pretty nice. Then you get 4 days in a row along the lakefront where, you know, the temperature not even cracked, you know, didn't even crack 50 degrees. And if you were walking in downtown Chicago, you know, it was 20-mile-an-hour wind, off and on, light rain, drizzle, fog. It was just, it's borderline terrible. And here's the time of the year when the average is supposed to be 65. So it's not that it's just, you know, cloudy, but it's just a miserable cloudy. And it was, we'll have one more day of this, but trust me, when the sun comes out, you're going to be amazed at how luscious and lovely everything looks, you know, in so many ways and shapes and shades of green. So it'll be worth the wait, but it doesn't stay warm very long. It'll go right back into a cool pattern.
I guess the only consolation we have is that we're not in Texas or Louisiana.
Oh my God, well, they've had what, almost 4 feet of rain since the beginning of the year. And it's amazing where they've gotten the heavy rain. They've gotten, you know what, almost three or four events of heavy rain. So the moss is actually probably growing moss in some areas. But you know what? You know, the rain that we got yesterday was beneficial. 0.6 inches at O'Hare. I saw a couple of places around the area that measured close to 0.8 inches. It was a nice, steady, soaking rain. It wasn't a flooding rain. And the rain that we've gotten so far for the month, 2.8 inches, most of it has occurred in little, you know, dribs and drabs, so to say. Even though we're down about 0.6 inches for the month, and we can use a little bit, I think the ground is doing, you know, is the soil moisture is doing pretty well. And, you know, Mike, when you look back at the month, I was calculating. I always like to do this for months where you have a lot of variation. We had 8 days where the temperatures were in the 40s. We had 8 days where the temperatures, and this is just the high temperature, was in the 50s. And probably 8 of those days where the temperature was in the 50s, I think we actually topped out at 50 degrees for about a cup of coffee. So you could probably say we were in the 40s most of the day.
Yeah.
We were in the 60s. We were in the 60s 4 days, the 70s 6 days, and the 80s 2 days. And we had a range from a high of 41 to 83. In addition to that, we had 6 days of snowfall and a total of 1.1 inches. So the month of April, boy, we really got as much out of it as possible from a standpoint of weather conditions, didn't we?
Yeah, and I would guess, I don't know for sure, but April certainly has to be the top one or two most variable months on the calendar.
Yeah, I think it's more so March due to the fact that you start off the month of March. You're literally still in the deep freeze with a foot of snow on the ground, and you can easily melt it by the end of the month. April doesn't seem to be that way. November, you can start out pretty mild and end up, you know, brutally cold with some, you know, big snowstorms. So typically it's March and then November. Those are your two most variable months. But April is right behind it. And it's mainly due to the fact that we are right up against the lakefront. Now, these numbers are actually O'Hare. Can you imagine if we actually looked back at climate data for, say, the Botanic Gardens or Waukegan, which you can do, or the lakefront, where you have, you know, much more variation in temperature. In fact, you know, last Sunday, I think the lakefront never got into the warm air. They stayed lake breeze all day. And this is like literally right along the lakefront. I think the high on Sunday was like 55. It jumped to 83 on Monday, and we had those beautiful thunderstorms that moved through the area with some large hail as well. And then the high on Monday was 47. And on top of that, the wind chill at one point was calculated to be 39. I mean, that's ridiculous. You had people literally going from shorts on Sunday to a, you know, winter coat and hat and gloves as you were walking along the, you know, the beaches or something like that. So it's the lake it's Lake Michigan that really does it more than anything, you know, the huge variations in temperature and obviously short-term weather as well.
So are you sticking to your proclamation last week that we really don't need to look at frost from this point on?
Yeah. Even if we do get another cold shot back through here, which is going to come through, it looks like Wednesday morning is when the next cold front comes through. A couple of things. Studies have shown that when you really begin to bloom out your vegetation, particularly the vegetation that's really sucking a lot of moisture out of the ground, it's really hard to get that top 1 or 2 inches of soil, you know, below the freezing level, you know, below 32 degrees. Because of the moisture that's in the ground, it's really hard to develop frost on top of that. That's one of the things, particularly if you've had, you know, a lot of days of heavy rain. You know, if you develop maybe frost on the top of a car, you know, something like that. But this is nothing where you're going to get into any sort of a, you know, a damaging or a killing frost. But looking at the maps from last night, or even from Friday night through Saturday and into Sunday, through this morning, I should say, the pattern literally goes right back to, you know, a very cold, windy pattern by Wednesday night into Thursday, but not the degree of cold that we've seen. And even if you look back at some of the cooler days that we've had, even since about the second week of April, we've not gotten even close to, you know, down into the, I think we had one day we got to like 33, 34 degrees, but the chances of getting the killing frost this time of the year go away very, very quickly over the next couple of weeks. I definitely think we're done with that, and I'm going to stick with that.
I have to do a quick shout out to Mike Bastian, who I got to know back when I was at Progresso Radio. And he's a guy, I mean, you know, you talk about me being in and out of the hospital. Who cares? This guy is fighting cancer and doing a pretty good job of it right now. And he wrote to me, this past week and said his son took your course or one of your courses at Loyola and loved it. Mm. Just thought you were the cat's pajamas.
But did he, but the key is, did he fill out the course evaluation and say that?
Yeah, you know, that is the point. If you don't get an evaluation, it's like it never happened, right?
Yeah, because all you need is one angry kid to go on ratemyprofessor.com, and then next thing, people go, oh, but you know what, that seems to be few and far between. But yeah. I don't remember the last name. I'd have to go back and look. I mean, I have 80 students this semester, including the summer semester as well, which begins literally next week after this week ends, and I got another 25 students there. But it's always, you know, like it's always nice to see about a year or two later, you get an email from a kid that says, you know, I got this job, I'm doing this, and I remember one day in class you mentioned this, and I'll never forget that, and thanks so much for that. Because every once in a while, I try to get to these kids' minds that it's not so much the grade you're getting, but it's the knowledge that you're getting.
Yeah.
And I don't care if you say, "Oh my God, that was hard," or "Take his class, it's easy." I don't want a kid to say that. I want a kid to say, "The class was hard. I learned a lot." And the conversation about the grade is not that important. If they were going for an A and I got an A minus, that's fine. But there are some students who are trying to keep that 4.0 going, and man, if they're getting an A minus, you're like a target.
Yeah, you know,
they got to take you down because you're the one person that kept them from getting that. So sometimes you got to be careful that you do even say those things, because I think these days kids go into school wanting to make sure that they get the perfect grade, but what they don't understand is when you get them into the real world, I don't really think bosses and managers so much look at the transcript. They want to know, can you come in and can you work in an environment with other people and take on challenges and do things that you've never done before and say, okay, let's see if we can make this work. Yeah, 4.0 is great, but you know, sometimes the 3s and the 3.5s are actually easy to work with. The 4s, those are the ones that go on for their PhDs. And you know, no disrespect to kids who get good grades, but I just don't think that matters as much in the long run. I really don't.
Yeah, I found his message that he sent me, and he says Rick DeMille was one of my son's favorite teachers at Loyola. So, you know, it hadn't occurred to me, Rick, that, you know, in our day, you didn't have this kind of recourse. You didn't go online and rate your professor. There's a tyranny of the internet here, isn't there?
Oh yeah. And you know what? It's interesting because I remember sitting in meetings and talking to other teachers about that, and they would say, "Oh, you shouldn't pay attention to that stuff." Blah blah blah. I'm like, "No, you really should, because when you ask kids which classes they take, that's the first thing they go to. They go to RateMyProfessor.com and they look at those reviews. They do. other than word of mouth, which after a while, if you got, you know, a good track record and you have good legs, blah blah blah, you've been there for a while, RateMyProfessor.com is one of the things that kids will look at to see whether or not they're going to take a course that's hard, when it's going to give them a lot of work. And one of the reasons I know this is I talked to my son and my three other nephews who all say the same thing. And it's nice when your nephew says, "Oh, Uncle Ricky, by the way, you have a couple of peppers next to your name," which means that you're hot, which I always forgot that you
said. La-di-da.
And I'm like, well, it's not my goal. It is, I think, also one of the, one of the downfalls of the web is that then kids could, or students, I should say, then ask questions or challenge you through an email. And it's as opposed to going to the teacher's office and getting, you know, more face-to-face on something that went wrong.
Yeah.
And we're, you know, the universities are obviously aware of that, and they tell us how to deal with stuff like that. But it's, you know, it's the wave of the future, and you have to embrace it and not push it off to the side. I think some older teachers do more of the pushing off to the side, and you got to change.
Well, let's give us that forecast, and I'll let you go.
Yeah, you know what? Like I mentioned, we got the rain last night. We'll have more rain that comes through later on this afternoon. Maybe about 4 or 5 hours of maybe about a tenth to about 0.2 of an inch. So, again, temperatures in the 40s today. We'll break out of some sunshine after a cloudy start tomorrow. Mid-50s Monday, probably mid to upper 60s on Tuesday. But, you know, normal high at 65, so it's easy to get to normal this time of year with some sun. And then the front comes back through. The cold air shifts the air back to the north on Wednesday. So Wednesday, temperatures only in the mid-40s. Winds generally out of north at about 20 to 30 miles an hour. It'll probably stay cool through Thursday. And then it looks like Friday, Saturday, and Sunday look fantastic. So if anybody is looking ahead to Mother's Day next week, the weather looks great with sunshine and temperatures in the mid-60s. So we're in between this, you know, cool, cloudy air mass over the Rocky Mountains and one to the north and east, and we'll finally get on the dry side of things by Friday. But after we get back into cool weather on Wednesday and Thursday, Friday and Saturday is going to seem a long way off.
My tomatoes are looking forward to the end of the week when things warm up again.
My short sleeve shirts are also looking forward to next week.
Yeah, well, you know, you got to dust them off and get the mustiness out of them too. So
they're at the front of my closet. I made that transition last week.
All right, Rick DeMille, meteorologist.
Have a good weekend.
You too. I'll talk to you next week.
Enjoy your birthday, Rick.
Okay, sounds good.
Bye.
Oh, yeah, thank you much.
And it was actually a couple of days ago. All right. Thank you all. Rocky start, but love the conversations we had today with Kate Copsey and Albert Ettinger and Cindy Skrickrud and the Calhouns out in LaSalle County. Look for the podcast, MikeNovak.net. I will post that. As always, go to the Mike Novak Show on Facebook. Please like me. I know that sounds sad, doesn't it, when you ask somebody to like you. But you're not liking me. You're liking the show. Or go and follow me on Twitter. Happy to have you do that. And, of course, always go to MikeNovak.net because I've got podcasts, I've got information, the write-ups about this show. You can go to the homepage, and if you click on the homepage, it takes you to the information from this week's show. And this is where Peggy gives a little plug for Natural Awakenings Magazine.
Thank you, Mike. Yes, well, we're checking websites. Please come and like us, too, nachicagonorth.com, nachicago on Facebook and Twitter. and look for a brand new, shiny new, purple covered May issue on the streets now.
All right. With that, all we have left to do is say, go green or
go home.